You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where if someone listens to an episode twice, we consider him two unique listeners. I'm your host, Justin M. Lesneski, and man, was this past Saturday crazy. There was a fan-run live stream convention called Justice Con, featuring a bunch of people who worked on Zack Snyder's Justice League, and it included an interview with Zack Snyder, and well, William, just play the clip.
There are people out there that are kind of misinformed about, you know, the difference between your movie and the movie that came out in 2017. And some of them are claiming that you're going to use some of Whedon's scenes, which you're not.
There would be no chance on earth that a shot that is made prior or after I left the movie. There would be no way. I would destroy the movie. I would set it on fire before I would use a single frame that I did not photograph. That is a fucking hard fact. And that is just, and it, you know, I mean,
we knew this, but I had to ask just so that we have,
you know. For the audience.
I literally would blow that fucking thing up.
What? Let's get some reactions. Joining me this trip from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, sounds like someone's read The Fountainhead.
I mean, just read it? I mean, he sounds like he's living it, doesn't it?
It does. I want to know if this new listener policy is because of the Chicago voting policy. Do we also count dead listeners? We also count those as this.
Any irrational policy that they use to get people to vote or to increase the count of coronavirus, because that's what it was a reference to, that's what we'll use as our listener count. So our listener count is 7 billion right now, because the way I count a listener is if you exist on this planet, then you are a listener.
Well, yeah. I mean, our sound waves are currently being broadcast by someone somewhere that then goes out into the air that then... breathed by 7 billion people. So yeah, I follow.
All right, so let's bring in our other guest from the unnecessarily expensive woke capital of the country, the voice of Trailer Takedown, whose race you'll never be able to figure out, so stop trying, you fucking collectivist, Dan Hackney.
Welcome to the midside. Yeah, good to be here again, and oh my god, that I hadn't heard that clip from Snyder before, but wow, that is what Howard Rourke in real life would sound like. Does sound like.
Exactly. Does sound like. Is it not, Dan? Is it not undeniable now the observations of objectivist ideas we've been finding in these movies? Now, I'm not saying he's an objectivist. I'm even hesitant to call myself one. But it's inarguable now that these ideas of individualism and hatred of the good that are in these movies, correct?
Yeah, oh my god. I mean, to say, yeah, I'd blow it up in particular is... I can't imagine... unless he literally said, "Hi, I'm making a reference to The Fountainhead and the scene," and like, that's about as clear as you're going to get without naming it directly.
My favorite, oh my God. And that's my favorite thing about that clip is if you listen to it, it escalates, and he's like, "Man, yeah. Destroy it. Oh, I'd light it on fire." And then you can almost hear his thoughts. You know what? I'm just going to go with the full Fountainhead reference. Yeah. You can hear him load it up and then execute it.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing, right? Art is fuel for the soul. And don't we have a very real example of Ayn Rand inspiring Zack Snyder in a moment of personal tragedy, both on his personal life and his professional life?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, God, now I really want to see the his Fountainhead movie, because I feel like he's been living it for the past, what, 3-4 years.
Exactly. And that's the thing. Like, we'll end this section and we'll transition into the news here. I don't see how you can be a fan of Zack Snyder and not want to pick up the Fountainhead now and not take these ideas that are in his movie seriously. And I don't see how you can be an objectivist and hear that quote and not go, wait, who is this guy? That would seem like pretty logical to me. So we'll see what happens. But it was a pretty cool moment, I think, for us here in the Midside. And it's nice because we talk about art being fuel for the soul, and there's a lot of craziness going on right now, so it's good for this to fuel us, and we can keep it in mind as we talk about things in the news without Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
As always, if you would like to support us, you can do so at Patreon or Locals.com. Locals.com is not a dating site. It is an actual, what kind of a site would we call that?
Justin, am single, so it can be a dating site for me.
Okay, it can be a dating site for William. Any site's a dating site, right?
That's right.
If you try hard enough.
That's what I always say about bars. Any bar's a gay bar when I go inside of it. So yeah, Locals.
Especially when bar is a euphemism for a man's asshole.
Locals, yeah, I haven't heard that one.
Locals is a new community building site, and lets us do fundraising and things without going through the Patreon woke police. So join locals.com, and you can donate every month. You can set how much you'd like to donate, and those keep the lights on.
Correct. And our URL there is themidside.com. The midside.locals.com, or you can go to themidside.com/locals. Same thing with Patreon. Patreon's per content, per piece of content you donate, and that's patreon.com/themidside or themidside.com/Patreon. First story this week is these. I love this entire week. We could have had any of these four stories go last because of how absurd they are. The first one is Joe Biden calls Trump the country's first racist president. That's right.
I'm going to go for a joke on that one.
During one of his, you know, campaign promotional things, Biden said that Trump's the first racist president. I'm just going to read the quote here. This is what Biden said. The way he deals with people based on the color of their skin, their national origin, where they're from is absolutely sickening. No sitting president has ever done this. Never, never, never. No Republican president has done this. No Democratic president. We've had racists, and they've existed. They've tried to get elected president. He's the first one that has. So I have two questions based upon all of this that both of you can answer, and we'll go to William first. So William, here are my two questions. The first is, so can we drop the whole idea that, like, Thomas Jefferson was a racist based on these comments? And two, is there, like, evidence or, like, video somewhere or audio of Trump dealing with people based on their skin color that I'm missing? I mean, I watched some of The Apprentice and Celebrity Apprentice and how he dealt with Omarosa, and he didn't deal with her based on her skin color. So am I missing this footage of him dealing with individuals?
Yeah, I think we're all missing that. As to the first point, yes, I think that Uncle Joe has decided that we can restore all the statues of Washington and Jefferson and even you know, I mean, technically weren't those Southern folks, didn't they call themselves presidents too? So maybe they aren't racist either. I don't know.
I don't know if he was referring to presidents of the Confederacy. I think he just meant the United States.
I just have to ask. We'll have to ask Uncle Joe.
If we ask him, he won't remember he said this, though.
Oh, that's true.
Oh.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, as to the, you know, what was this? The second question, it was about, see, I'm stuck on imagining, like, Uncle Joe blessing these statues, and I just can't get that out of
well,
my mind.
Well, what I'm asking, and I think the more interesting question is, his phrasing is, the way he deals with people based on the color of their skin, their national origins, where they're from. And I know we can't argue he has policies like, you know, let's build a wall, and you know, he blocks immigration, and we've seen him revoke green cards to groups. But he's acting like, these quote makes it seem like Trump is dealing with individuals based on their skin color, their national origin, and things like that. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Also, it's weird to lump... It's weird to me that we lump all of these things together. Like, isn't there a sense in which it does matter what your country you're from? Like, for things like immigration? Like, that seems to matter at some level. Or at least a generalization that you should use.
I mean, if there's a pandemic going on and most of the people in a certain country are infected, doesn't where you come from matter?
Kind of, yeah.
I would assume so, but apparently that's racist.
Is that racist, Dan?
As the official race expert decider of the Midside, I decree that judging whether to allow someone in based on the pandemic status of their country is not racist.
Well, awesome. Thank God. I mean, well, this hurts my brain, like, in so many ways, because... So they're trying to keep Joe Biden quiet, right? Because their strategy is basically what Hillary should have done, which is just stand around and, you know, let Trump hang himself, right? Now, I don't think that's a good strategy because, well, one, it didn't work so much for Hillary, but not just that. I think Trump is too good at provoking the Democrat base to be all weird and wild, which causes the Republican base to become energized. I don't think they get that. His power is not in that he's some sort of competent, strategy or strategery person, right? It's that he knows he has a button that he can push, and he just pushes that button over and over again until his voters come out. So
let's be honest. He's just a troll. That's what it is. Like, everybody is so corrupt that he knows if he just trolls enough that he'll get the voters to be on his side by just pointing out how corrupt everyone else is. That's his entire strategy.
And it's disappointingly effective.
Yeah, but to a certain extent, like, it's kind of funny at this point.
Sure, yeah. It's... That's... The Schadenfreude is definitely real with that. But it's... It seems... It's so predictable, too. And the solution to it seems so simple that, you know, if people on the left just stopped taking the bait as much, his whole cycle would break down. But that, it's inconceivable to me that people wouldn't have picked up on this before, is that, like, he says something, people say something, he says something crazy, people in response say something way crazy, and then people are like, well, out of the two crazies, he kind of seems marginally less crazy, which is weird to say. And if you just don't respond so crazily to his crazy, then that whole strategy doesn't work.
100%. You just have to laugh at him, right? Like, there was a tweet on I think it was the 20th. At least I shared it in Discord on the 20th. This is a real tweet from Donald Trump, right? And I think this is, to be clear, I don't support Donald Trump. I'm not voting in the next election. But I think this is just a hilarious troll tweet. We are united in our effort to defeat the invisible China virus. And many people say that it is patriotic to wear a face mask when you can't socially distance. And there's a picture of him wearing a face mask. There's nobody more patriotic than me, your favorite president. Now, this is the guy who was, like, telling no, like, he hated the mask thing, right? And now he's like, oh, not only am I going to wear a mask, I'm going to act like it's my idea and I'm proud of it. Because he's turning the leftist rhetoric on its head, right? The idea that you have to do this and be proud of it. And then he calls himself your favorite president. Like, he's trolling them. He's saying, I know you hate me. Like, this, I'm sorry. Should the President of the United States be tweeting these things? No.
God, no.
Unequivocally, no. Is it hilarious that he did? Unequivocally, yes.
Fair. One of the things I thought was so strange is that the way out of this whole gaffe for Biden would have been extremely simple. He could have said, Trump is the first racist president in recent history. And like, well, okay, you can kind of argue that. And, you know, then if people start challenging him on it, you can quibble over what exactly you mean by recent history. And pretty soon people have forgotten about it. And like, would it still be, I don't know, kind of a semi-dishonest smear tactic? Sure, but it's one that isn't nearly as absurd on its face. And, you know, we probably wouldn't be talking about it if it's like, well, you know, what do we define? How bad was Reagan compared to Trump? Like, how do you deter? If you get into that whole conversation, then the issue dies away. But if without that qualifier, now he's kind of stuck with this.
Well, now the 80s is ancient times now.
Sure, exactly. Yeah,
that's in the before time.
Yeah, and so you can say, oh, that, yeah, and I, recent history, I meant, you know, since Obama.
That's how they get out of the W thing, because I was going to say, they call every Republican racist.
Sure, yeah, and so it's, I mean, it's not an honest way to conduct a debate, but it's, you know, this would seem like, if I'm thinking of it and I have exactly zero political or, you know, being elected class president type experience, like, yeah, it's not just add a qualifier, and then if people challenge you, you can quibble over the qualifier, and people won't care about having that debate, and so they'll move on. But instead, he painted himself in this corner.
Talk about moving on and how to deal with things. The next story is why I called in black at work and how I used that time to heal. And I'm glad we have our racial expert here, our racist expert on the show.
Racist
to declare things racist or not. Not calling you racist.
Wow.
Yeah.
But
our racist expert.
It's perfect. I love it.
It sounds like the Adam Carolla bit, the whatever Ernest T. Bigot or Ernest Lee Bigot.
So I'm going to read a couple quotes here. I'm going to read a couple quotes here from this article because... wow, this article.
Wait, right. Justin, don't we need a trigger warning? Isn't this a black mouth? Question mark? What's
whatever, our entire show is a trigger warning.
Black voice? I don't know. Can you even read this?
A trigger warning.
You have a white voice.
I mean, I'm capable.
Yeah.
But we'll see. We'll see. We'll see how offended Dan gets or not. So
appropriation.
Right. Appropriation.
Well, I would argue this woman is appropriating one of our concepts. So let's discuss that. In one of her videos, Evelyn from the internet introduced the idea of calling in black. She takes viewers through an everyday person calling off work. This time was unique because she was calling off to grieve the death of Sandra Bland. Bland was a black woman who died in police custody. While the video was lighthearted, it was imbued with a seriousness that I could relate to because I yearned for time to grieve. I realized that calling in black was my only option to take time and truly acknowledge my distress. At work, there was no space reserved to mourn these deaths. Second quote.
Am I supposed to, as an employer, am I supposed to have a space where people can mourn?
In the corner by the bathroom.
Okay.
So just put it over there and be like, that's the mourning
space. The mourning space. Okay.
The mourning space.
Which emotions am I supposed to have spaces for? I mean, I only have so much tile in the store.
Just base it off of the movie Inside Out and put pictures on the wall, like, you know, like giant fat heads of each of those characters, and say, if you're feeling those emotions and you need time to deal with them, just go stand under that fat head so we know what emotion you're trying to work through.
So out of the 100% of space that's in the store, how much of it should be devoted to making money versus providing space?
Zero.
Zero. Oh. Yeah, that's easy.
Obviously zero. These are just excuses for you to not have a profit.
Got it.
Second quote. When I finally took time off, in the spirit of Maxine Waters, I was reclaiming my time. I rid myself of work responsibilities and focused on me. To affirm that my mental health was a priority, I closed the curtains, lit lavender candles, and took a warm shower. Don't get that drop, William!
I can't wait to get that drop.
Oh.
Also, isn't this the start of, like, some sort of, like, you know, artsy French pornographic film?
I'd watch that.
Yeah, I mean, I thought she was going to say she masturbated next, but she skips ahead.
She skipped that part. That part, she that stage ahead. Of warning. It's a little known stage, but...
Yeah.
I don't know. It helps me feel better when I'm mourning. I mean, that's not what mourning wood means. It was when I began to dry off. See, dry off? You see the subtle, the subtle wink there? That my apartment gradually stopped shrinking. First of all, if your apartment's shrinking...
You're in an
that's
earthquake.
A problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're in an earthquake or Ant-Man has taken over, like, consult a scientist or you don't like police. I don't know who you would consult, but fix that problem.
A psychologist.
Yeah. Well, that's really the thing here, right? This is what I don't understand, and this is the question I want to ask both of you. Isn't this just called calling in sick? Like, when you call in sick, do you tell people why? Are you like, I'm calling in sick because I'm upset that... the finale of How I Met Your Mother was trash. If you want to call in sick for that reason, you can do that. But you just say, I'm not feeling well. I'm calling in sick. You don't have to tell them, right? You can take a mental health day. So to me, this seems very performative. The whole, is she literally calling in black? She's like, so I need to talk to HR. Hi, HR. I'm calling in black this morning.
Yeah, I'm black today. I gotta take the day off work until that resolves itself.
So I want to know. I mean, you normally check this privilege, but can I call in gay?
Ooh.
And I don't see why not.
Yeah.
I mean, which identities are we allowed to use as an excuse?
Well, can you only call them in when something that affects your group identity happens? Like, can you call in black, like, the day Patrick Mahomes wins the Super Bowl because that's a good thing? Like when that's Obama was.
Well, I was gonna go to a different direction, Justin. Next time they throw a gay person off a building in Saudi Arabia or Iran or something, should I call in gay so I could mourn the death of this person I don't know?
Right, exactly. That was the inverse of what I was saying. That's the point I'm making. So you can only call in gay if gays are thrown off buildings in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I'll just keep that in mind.
But Saudi Arabia specifically. Yeah, I, as kind of baseline ridiculous as a lot of this is, I think there's a real, like, legitimate important thing here, which is that, I mean, it sounds like she was having an actual panic attack. We can kind of ask, you know, is it some indication of, you know, something maybe unhealthy that you identify so much with these people that got killed that you're having a panic attack? But, like, if you're having a panic attack to the extent that you're not able to get work done, like, yeah, call in sick, take a bath, like, do whatever it is you need to do to get yourself feeling better. Like, that aspect of it I was totally on board with and makes sense and everything, but it's the idea that, one, it seems like she was implying that this is somehow, like, incumbent on the company to do something specifically for her.
Well, provide a space to work. I mean, we should
pay exactly.
While she's taking this bath, right?
Absolutely. And so it's kind of my reaction was a combination of, like, yeah, mental health is a real thing, take care of it, and it seems like you're going beyond just, I was having some mental health issues, and so I took a day off. Because I likened it to, you know, like, what is my reaction when I hear about somebody dying from a drunk driver hitting their car? It's like, I drive cars occasionally, and I'm in cars not as much anymore. And, like, that's something that could happen to me. And it's a tragedy when somebody dies from driving drunk, but it doesn't, you know, send me into an emotional tailspin. Whereas, you know, in sometimes past when, like, people have gotten canceled or fired or whatever for, you know, expressing non-orthodox views, that does seem to hit me more. So I was trying to figure
Did you say non-orthodox Jews?
Views.
Yeah, Dan's been traveling cars less since he's been testing the new autonomous drone delivery. So he's just having himself delivered everywhere.
I cannot confirm or deny. But so what is the link between, okay, you know, I drive in cars, people die in cars, I have non-woke ideas, people have gotten fired for non-woke ideas. Why does one feel like, yeah, it's a thing that happens and I'm not really going to worry about it, and another feels like, oh, this is something that could happen to me, I actually am kind of worried about it. Because that's what seems, you know, she almost certainly doesn't get similarly distraught over every person who dies from anything, even people who are in some way like her who die. To the, you know, the question I would have her ask herself or ask a therapist or friend or whatever is, why are you having this strong reaction over these deaths and not others? And how do you feel about that? Is there something to do there?
Yeah, Dan, I think you're falling into the trap, though, of seeing this as more than just performative. This is just another virtue signal. I can't take this seriously. Like, I have no doubt that the emotion is really happening. That's not what I'm saying at all. But this is all performative in the sense that this is a state that people in the woke church get themselves into, kind of like the Pentecostals and the, rolling around on the floor and speaking in tongues. This is an emotional state that they build and they work on and they construct so that they can do this performative action. And they really feel these emotions. I mean, the ideas that they have internalized do cause emotions, right? Like, and so yeah. I'm not denying the mental issue or the emotion here by saying this, but this is a constructed thing that they've done to themselves.
And that's the real, I'm going to split the difference between both of you, because I agree with both of you. And I think there's an important point that comes out of what you're both saying. And the important point is, by splitting the difference, we can't deal with what's really going on because of these things, because it becomes like the boy who cried wolf, or it becomes, you know, I get what Dan's saying. Like, figure out how to deal with this. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not going to go into this. There are a number of things I could speculate about internalized collectivism, internalized Marxism. I could go in very many different directions with this, but I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a therapist.
Internalized woke.
But then internalized woke, right. But then my empathy is lessened tremendously because of what William just said with the internalized woke. How do you take it seriously when it seems like they're crafting this and they're cultivating this and they always find a way to go back to this? So what happens is, whatever real problems may exist with racism in this country, whatever real problems may exist with authoritarianism in this country, we can't actually discuss because we're distracted and we're minimizing everything because of the way it's treated by everyone. And I think that's the real issue here.
You know, they want to put racist or racism as in the psychology handbook. I think we should also put woke. That's the only way I would allow racism to be there. I would want both racism. I mean, they're both racist ideologies. So, but if we put them both in, maybe closer.
Well, and the interesting thing about that, right? Well, we did see that comedy video, right, by Ryan Long. Go look that up, showing how racism and woke are the same thing.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about what you're saying about the psychology handbook, William, is it's interesting to me that we don't take philosophy seriously as a species to the point that we let it be subsumed by religion. We let it be subsumed by politics. We let it be subsumed now by psychology. So even though racism is an issue of philosophy that can lead to affecting your psychology, now we're just saying it's a purely psychological issue. Speaking of that, more about the Portland protests. I can't get past all of this stuff. It's fascinating to me. This is all fascinating to me. And the article I picked out this week is Portland protesters worry violence is taking away from Black Lives Matter message. Before I read, exactly, that's what I was going to say. Before I read any quotes, haven't we talked about that since this started on this show?
I think I want to get into the quotes, but I have an answer. So
okay, so let's do the quotes, Dan. Oh, I thought I heard you speaking. Were you not speaking?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay, then I'm just going to read the quotes. All right.
Yeah.
2 months after the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis sparked nationwide protests against racial injustice, and a week after President Donald Trump sent federal officers to Portland to confront activists, another night of chaos unfolded in this largely liberal, mostly white, where residents have continuously taken to the city, to the streets, to demand substantive police reform. Second quote. A lot of the people who are doing it are not black. They throw shit and start shit and run away and yell Black Lives Matter and then go home and take off their clothes. I mean, doesn't everyone go home and take off their clothes? That seems like a superfluous phrase.
I'm a never nude.
But I can't take off my black, Phillips said. Okay, so taking off clothes
is
apparently
the same. Wait, you can call in black, but you can't call in not black?
It's really confusing.
Well, no wonder they have psychological issues, Dan, if it's that confusing.
I thought they declared that Thomas Sowell was not black, right? So didn't he take off his black?
How can a black man whose name is Sowell not be black? Like, he literally has Sowell. That's probably what's going to get me canceled, that joke right there.
There you go.
And the more damage they do to this building, well, everyone thinks it's people of color doing all this, and it's not. And this is the main thing that, I mean, there's a lot about race we can unpack here if we want, but the main thing that is, like, Scott Adams loves to talk about that there, you know, there are always two movies. People see things differently, and there are two stories, right? He talked about it with coronavirus and all that. And now here, there are two different movies where some people are saying these are all just peaceful, justified protesters, and others are saying they're riots. Now, I fall under more the riot side, where I say, yes, there are protesters, and some of them are out there legitimately protesting and not causing violence, but I see Antifa hijacking this, and I don't know how you don't see, William, how do you not see the video of them trying to tear down the fences at the courthouse and throwing in Molotov cocktails?
I don't know, and that's exactly what I want to discuss. So I talked to a lot of different people, this is the store and things like that. And the last couple weeks, last week I had off for a week, I was able to talk to a ton of different people. And that's one thing I sort of, like, you know, gets woven into the conversation about riots. And it was amazing to me. For some people, the media have done a great job of not, of hiding the violence, right? When I mentioned about the firebombing, some people were like, really? I knew it was bad. I didn't realize it was that bad. And I would show them the video from Andy Ngo and encourage them to follow Andy Ngo. And I think that this article is not, the reason this article even gets printed is not because they're worried about the violence. It's because they're worried that their narrative is leaking out, right? That the actual truth is leaking into the narrative. And that's what this article is really about. That wait, maybe we're not hiding the violence well, right? We're not apologizing for the violence well enough. The optics need to change, right? They had all those supposed moms being body shields during that riot, right? That's some crazy ass tactics that should be all over the news. It's not, right?
Who uses their mom as a body shield? Can you imagine, like, Jerome Bettis puts his mom on the field to block for him?
Call me transphobic, but there were some definitely not people capable of having children moms in the mom party.
Transphobic.
I know.
That's how you get canceled.
I'm just canceled. To be clear, what I'm saying there is it was performative, right? They were saying what human shields will have the most sympathy? Well, mothers. So we'll pretend like all these people are mothers. We'll dress them differently than the Black Bloc when they're all just the Black Bloc, right?
Point of order, wouldn't the human shields that have had the most impact at this point have been Black people? Because everyone would have been like, oh my God, they're attacking the black people in the protest to protect the black people.
Because the logic is
it's about
the police
sacrifice.
Are so horribly racist that they'll, you know,
that'll enrage them.
Shoot black people on sight, but and it'll enrage them. But if they see a, you know,
a
nice,
white
good
mother.
White suburban mom, then they'll be, ooh, I can't shoot her. She's a person that counts.
Besides, remember the Al Sharpton video where apparently white people are only good for being shields, right?
I do remember that, but I do think they're overestimating every white suburban kid's relationship with his or her mother.
Yeah, one thing that came to mind for me with this is, you know, I think both things are going on. There are both people actually protesting peacefully, and there's a whole lot of violence going on. There've been people have been trying to burn down that federal courthouse for months now, and you know, saw videos of assaults on federal officers and just all that stuff. And so, even you know, who knows what the actual percentage is, one way or another. But if you're in a situation where you have a big crowd of people, 95, 98, whatever percent are totally fine and a small percent are violent, how do you keep that from spiraling out of control from the perspective of the police and from the perspective of other people in that march? There was that guy, Idris Phillips, one of the guys quoted, who was trying to keep people off the fence, trying to maintain order. He was a protester saying, hey, everybody, don't climb the fence. Don't make any act, do any action that looks like we're trying to cause violence. And that's good. That's what people in that protest should be doing, is, you know, removing the ability of the police on the scene and the people watching from home to say, oh yeah, it seems like just kind of a violent thing, and so I guess the police are justified. That's the other side of the whole Martin Luther King nonviolence thing that people seem not to talk about as much. Is part of the point of it was to create the optics of a bunch of protesters completely above reproach, and then the police flipping out and beating them. And so anyway you look at it, it's like, wait, why do the police have to send the dogs and water cannons and beat this guy who is, you know, standing there in a, you know, Sunday best suit, not harming anyone? It's hard to have sympathy when the person you're beating up has, in, you know, no conceivable way done anything wrong. But if you have, well, there's some people breaking stuff and some people protesting, but are they giving cover for the people breaking stuff? That message becomes muddier. So from the protesters' perspective, it becomes really in their interest to make sure that the violence doesn't escalate.
Well, that's because I think that's easy. It's easy to understand when you put the goals in mind. The goals of the folks perpetrating the violence is the destruction of American institutions, not the reification, the rededication to those ideas, right? Martin Luther King was very explicit,
and William,
he wanted to rededicate us to individual life.
Right, and to follow up on that real quick, William, and then you can continue. I don't think what Dan said, I don't think they're necessarily trying to burn the courthouse down. I think in order to achieve the goal you just said, William, they're trying to spark a conflict with the federal officers in order to radicalize other people when they say, oh, look, the federal government is attacking us.
Yeah, yeah. And getting back to the two movies thing, like, I think that's pretty insightful when it comes to not just the coverage itself, right? But the whole idea that people are unable to integrate these facts with or untangle the confusion that's happening there. And I mean, how many of you guys in the audience know that Portland has voted to abolish their prisons? Like that's the next thing on their list of things to abolish. Right?
What?
Yeah. Yeah, they've moved forward with on the next step of abolishing their prisons. So, I don't know. I don't know at what point we declare Portland a failed state, but I think it's going to come soon. But that's not going to get covered anywhere. because it doesn't fit the narrative necessarily, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing about all of this is just the insanity of the narrative around all of this, because I agree with what Dan was saying. Like, there are a number of steps that can be taken that the protesters can, you know, take in order to protect themselves. I just heard an echo. Did anyone else hear it?
Yeah. Somebody joined in, was unmuted.
Oh, okay.
We're
good.
Yep, I fixed it.
Okay. There are a number of steps they can take in order to protect themselves. I mean, you can find other ways to protest, right? If you know every time you show up, there are those violent assholes who show up, you stop showing up, right? You change your plans. Now, that means in today's day and age, it's really hard, right? Because they're always going to be able to show up. So maybe it's maybe now it's time to revolutionize what protesting means. You can also find a way, if you know that this is always going to happen, you can find a way to fight back against these people and minimize them and not let them in, right? So there are any number of things you can do. But the broader issue here is the narrative and how the narrative has been internalized. I mean, this even goes back to the calling in black story, right? How the narrative has been internalized by these people to the point that you almost can't tell the difference. You almost can't find who's going to be the protester and who's going to be the rioter, because to a certain extent, these protests have been incited in order to make it so they can incite them into riots. Does that make sense, what I'm trying to say?
I think for some people, that's part of the idea. And the problem is, from a distance from the outside, you can't really tell who's here for what and who's part of what. The crowd is so dense and undifferentiated that there's no way to identify, like, okay, that person really just wants to end police brutality. That person just wants to break stuff. This person's like, well, if stuff gets broken, then maybe that would be okay. Like, you can't distinguish that both from the police on the ground and the people watching at home. And so it's easy to say, to take, you know, 10 examples of any kind of behavior and say, oh yeah, this is what the whole thing is about, in any direction.
Right. And that's exactly what I'm saying. And I'm saying it on an intellectual level. Yeah. Is you just said purely pragmatic stuff. I'm saying on an intellectual level, the ideas that have been cultivated in all of us are what have led to this. And that's intentional by certain groups of people who are trying to use it in order to, as William said, what did you say so eloquently, William? Just, you know, not recommit to the ideas, but to tear them down.
Yeah, to redid. Yeah, instead of rededicating ourselves to individual rights, to just destroy American system.
All right, and they're trying to fight fascism, right? So speaking of tearing down the American system and fascism, our final story is: Como defines substantive food after restaurants bend rules with Como chips. Spokesperson clarifies. So the new rule that apparently the left is using, right? They always come up with stuff every once in a while to make our life more inconvenient. You know, they tried to do like the soda tax or the sweet tax or whatever in New York. And then they did the plastic bag in certain places. I know you guys are still dealing with that in California. Actually, Mid-Center Michael is here.
Dude, real quick. Plastic bags have come back.
Oh, yeah.
Every store has plastic bags now because of it's coronavirus. Glorious. If there's any positive thing that comes from all the deaths caused by coronavirus, it's that we get our plastic bags back.
100% worth it.
Yep.
Easy trade.
Do you have to pay 10 cents for them?
No, they're giving them away free. At least at the stores around here, yeah. Giving them away free.
I'm pretty sure I got to pay 10 cents.
Well, that's because you're in the woke capital of the world.
I mean, that's true.
Maybe it's a rule thing like this story, though. Maybe they will have to start charging. I think it depends on the store. I don't think Vons is doing it right now, at least the Vons in my neighborhood. They're just passing out.
Well, it's one of those things that it's really unenforceable if everyone just decides to not do it anymore, right? The only way it's enforceable is if you go in there with a gun, and the government doesn't really want to do that yet. But so I can throw away my plastic bags here, because Midsider Michael bought stuff at Disney Springs and he was going to throw his plastic bag away. And I was like, no, I'll keep it, because eventually that's going to come here, because that's how this stuff spreads. You're telling me I don't have to worry about it anymore? I can throw my plastic bags away?
As long as people are worried about sanitation, which, oh my God, isn't that something I brought up on the show about how unsanitary it is to use reusable bags? Now all of a sudden, now that there's coronavirus, people are like, wait, it's unsanitary to use these reusable bags. You cannot bring a reusable bag into Whole Foods. They like the guard will not let you in here. The only way I've brought in the old Whole Foods paper bags is because I have glass return bottles. But then I have to leave the paper bag at the return bottle and like no one touches it. It's like in a special area. I have to go drop it all, or show the cashier how many bottles I have and then put it in the bin, in the unclean bin.
What? And then put it under biological quarantine?
I guess so. I don't know. But I agree with this one thing. It is unsanitary. The disposable plastic bags are the most sanitary way to transport.
Well, apparently I read a thing, so you know, take that for what it's worth, that the number of times you'd have to reuse a reusable bag to offset the increased fossil fuel or, you know, hydrocarbon cost of making it is like in the hundreds. So if you use your nice fancy reusable bag less than like 300 times before throwing it away or losing it or whatever, you'd actually, from a oil consumption perspective, have been better off just using plastic bags.
And I'm sure that's with no washing of them. Because think of the energy it takes to wash it.
Okay, I didn't mean to turn this into an anti-plastic or anti-reusable bag segment, but I'm for it. But the point is...
Hey, Justin, I get at least one rant a season.
No, it's great. I very clearly said I'm for it. I agree with everything both of you said. And the left has come up with another way of doing this. Apparently the new thing of making our life inconvenient is to make it so you cannot sell alcohol in an establishment unless you are also selling food. They do this in New York City. I think they're trying to do it somewhere. One of our midsider, Kevin, I believe, in Discord said that they're doing it in Pennsylvania as well. So it's probably in the leftist Northeast right now. But apparently people started rebelling this by selling like chips and calling them Como chips. And here's a quote from the article. Apparently irritated over small businesses selling appetizers named after him in order to skirt rules and stay open and afloat, Democratic Governor of New York Andrew Cuomo has cracked down on what he considers real food. Another quote. Earlier today, Governor Cuomo said chicken wings are not substantial food for bars to be allowed to sell alcohol. He added that sandwiches were the lowest level of substantive food. William, can you remind me what fascism is again?
It is declaring that that sandwiches are the lowest level of substantive food. As a sandwich seller, I am offended deeply. Sandwiches can be the highest level of substantive food, the most delicious of substantive food. Justin, this is happening in California. You know, like I said, I took a little vacation, had some friends in town. We drove down to San Diego. It was supposed to be last weekend. Would have been Pride weekend. I think we talked about it on the show a little bit. And in San Diego, went to Baja Betty's to get a drink after eating lunch. And we had to order, the two of us that ordered drinks, had to order food. I had to order a real full appetizer that we just didn't eat so that we could sit outside, because it was outdoor seating, and have some drink and visit with our friends. This is definitely happening. I wonder, though, Justin, is this political speech, though? Like calling these Como chips and then selling them? Like, who, you know, couldn't someone challenge this pretty easily? And also, just a little more context before I let you answer that. The law, apparently, is from the 60s that said that it had to be substantive food, but they just had basically stopped enforcing it in the late 70s and early 80s. And, you know, if you remember, you go into a bar in New York, they always have, like, peanuts or something, right? Or some sort of food. But no one really enforced this liquor law. But now they've decided, because it's... because there's Como chips, it's time to enforce the law.
Ah, the 80s. I'm probably looking at them through rose-colored glasses because I was born then. But I'm actually going to throw that question you asked me to Dan over here, because I think there's a broader question here. I think this is fightable. I think there are many things in our country that are easily fightable. Up to and including wearing masks to fight the coronavirus. Yeah, I said it. why don't we fight back in general, Dan, against these things that are easy to fight? Why do we so easily accept the slow creep of fascism?
I mean, there's a bunch of reasons. I think for one, a just very basic practical case is that fighting it is disproportionately expensive for, you know, bar owners who are having a extremely difficult time now. And so for every little encroachment, a lot of people reasonably ask, is this the hill I want to die on? And, you know, okay, so I have to serve, you know, something I can plausibly call a sandwich instead of Cuomo chips. Like, okay, maybe I don't like this, but I'll put up with it. You know, versus fighting it could be, I don't know, you could have your business shut down, you could end up in court for a long time. You know, I can understand.
You could have your liquor license pulled. Yeah.
Yeah, you could have your liquor. Oh, my God.
So government is the ultimate patent troll, then.
Yeah.
And by analogy, yeah. But I think the more fundamental thing is the mindset that the government is here to take care of us and save us from ourselves and ought to do that because, oh, we would just be left to our own devices. We're going to make dumb decisions and, you know, eat paint and run with scissors. And so there's a tolerance for
these I'd go to that
kinds
bar.
Of things. I mean, that sounds like a blast. But if you can say, oh, this is for health and safety, people, you know, to a first approximation will say, oh, yeah, health and safety. Yeah, we can't let people just do their own thing. That, you know, they might hurt themselves. And it allows you to do all sorts of stuff like this under some fig leaf guise of health and safety. You know, in the case of coronavirus, some of these things are legitimate, but they get package dealt with a bunch of nonsense like this, as if eating a sandwich versus chips is going to prevent the coronavirus somehow.
Yeah.
I don't even understand what the logic is.
If we're trying to be more contextual about, like, looking at a broader context of, like, we want these businesses to survive. We realize, you know, we want to promote social distancing and mask wearing, things like that. We've seen some cases where they say, I know, like, in Long Beach, for example, they're allowing more outdoor seating that they wouldn't allow normally, right? They're saying you can take over the sidewalk and set up tables. This is all great. You could have, instead of saying you must buy food like this and it must be substantive, like, I guess the goal there is to not encourage people to go out, which at first you're like, oh, well, that makes sense. We don't want people to go out. But I thought the reason we were easing these restrictions is to let businesses survive. Why don't you say instead, hey, places that don't serve food, you know, be able to serve food, right? Loosen the restrictions, let these people actually serve food. And then, I don't know, that wouldn't work in New York. In California, there's bars that their license forbid them from serving, right? And and so they can't even sell, like, prepackaged it. So,
oh my God.
Yeah, so it doesn't, it's in conflict with the whole concept of opening back up, right? Of allowing these businesses to try and survive. You're putting handcuffs on them in the name of safety that prevent them from actually doing business. Like, who's, what's the real goal here, right? And which goals are we integrating together? And that's, I think, what the problem is with this kind of, like, well, people are getting around it by selling Cuomo chips. No, they're trying to serve their customers. Their customers don't want food. They want alcohol, right? They've come here to sit with their friends at a table, not to, not to order food. They're not hungry.
Yeah, and it's how dare Cuomo decide what the proper social gathering is. Oh, a proper social gathering is one where you both drink and have substantive food. It's like, who the hell asked him? How is it any of his business? Also, I look forward to, you know, assuming that this goes through and restaurants actually do start serving sandwiches. I look forward to, in a couple of weeks, breathless stories about, look at all the food they're wasting at these bars. We have to crack down on this because they're just wasting food.
Well, and have they...
isn't there more of a risk if you're making food than pouring a drink of spreading the virus, too?
Almost certainly.
And have they defined, like how many... Like, what the dimensions of a sandwich must be? Like, what the size of a sandwich must be?
I'm just picturing, like, a, you know, half-inch by half-inch sandwich.
Justin, have you ever ate a Buffalo Wild Wings and ordered wings? That was not substitute food.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Like, did Hooters just get put out of business? Because their entire thing is, like, come to Hooters for our wings.
I order Wingstop for football games. It's like a tradition. So, apparently, yeah. That's zero calories. It's not substitute. So,
Doesn't it depend on how many wings you eat? I mean, because Daniel and I, there used to be, when we were at Clemson, there used to be a wing place we would go to, and it would be buy a pound, get a pound free. So we'd each sit there and eat 2 pounds of wings. Like, that's not substantive?
Oh, man. Now I want, at Michigan, the wing place was called Mr. Spots. Now I want some Mr. Spots.
Mm. All right, so let's end there, and we can all think about some wings, and we'll probably all get wings for dinner now. But first, we're going to talk about some trailers in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. If you want to continue the conversation with us during the week, you can join our Discord channel. In fact, if you want to watch trailers before the episode, I put them in the Discord. Likewise, I put in lots of stories we don't talk about, trailers we don't talk about. For instance, we're not going to talk about the Bill and Ted 3 trailer that premiered during Virtual Comic Con. I did tweet about it. I tweeted my prediction about the movie. But you can find those kind of things in the Discord. So you can go to themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast, click on any episode and click on the Join Discord link, and you can join us and talk with us during the week. For now, though, let's head into a special for William video game only trailer takedown.
Video takedown.
Video game trailer takedown. I'm here.
First,
I can do the
trailer. Weird.
That was awesome. Ghosts of Tsushima? Is that how you say that? How do you say that?
Tsushima.
I don't know. I'm racist. I'm dating an Asian girl. But not all Asians are the same. She's Filipino. A storm is coming. This seemed to be a video game about a samurai. I'm not going to lie. I laughed during this trailer because it was so stereotypical. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, that's what they're trying to tell. They're trying to tell a traditional story about a Japanese samurai. And you know what? It looks like they executed this pretty well. I mean, the graphics are pretty good. It's exactly what it's meant to be. Am I going to play it? I don't really play video games, so I don't know if it's really good for me to, you know, do a trailer takedown segment. But I'm going to do this. I'm going to say whether I liked the trailer, not whether I played the game, because the answer is I'm not going to play any of these games. But for this trailer and what they were trying to execute, I'm going to say hug.
Hug.
William?
Yeah, so I really like this trailer. I think it's only on PlayStation, though, so I don't know if I'll be able to play the game. But I've been talking to people who have played the game and been watching some Twitch streams on it, too. It looks like a lot of fun. They've done a really good job with the gameplay, and the story apparently is pretty good. You're right, it is sort of... It's stereotypical in that it's very true to the setting. But Justin, the whole reason I wanted to talk about this is the reactions on the reviewers and on Twitter.
Oh, God. What happened?
So some Asian Americans are apparently offended at how racist this is because it's so stereotypical, and so this was hilarious to the Japanese critics, who have all very highly praised this game for a lot of reasons. They've written some great reviews, but apparently the woke in America apparently are telling Japanese critics that they don't know how to criticize a game about Japanese culture, which I find hilariously ironic.
Oh my god! Yeah, so I know.
Well, you didn't give your
Oh, say hug or tag. Definitely gonna hug.
Hug. All right. So I know exactly nothing about this game other than just having seen the trailer. And visuals were amazing. I agree. It sounded, it looked very generic in its story and layout. My expectation from what the game would be about is that it would be sort of a generic hacky slashy kind of game, like a third person action, maybe RPG. If you stray from the path, what will you become line, maybe think, ah, so there's going to be a moral choice system, maybe a stealth versus combat option. My guess is that you are a knight or samurai of the Empire, then the Empire betrays you, and now you have to fight against those who you once served, which is the video game plot line.
Is this Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic you're describing?
It's not exactly that. So the story is
literally
more,
every game that I'm describing.
Yeah, the story is more that in order to fight the Mongol invasion, this person is straying from the traditional samurai fighting style with this more guerrilla style. And he's good at both, and so it's this moral conflict. Like, does he defend his country with this immoral style, or do they go down in sort of an honorable defeat, right? And that's the conflict in the game. Like, what choices are you making? Are you, because the, you know, are you acting more without, you know, spoiling too much, are you acting more like a ninja, or are you acting more like a samurai, right?
See, that's actually, I could see, that's actually interesting. I can kind of see that from the trailer, but anyway, I don't have a PlayStation. Looks like it could be interesting. I don't really see any, you know, you don't see any of the gameplay in it, and that's tends to be more of what I show up for games about, so tackle?
Okay, before we move on before we move on to the second trailer, I didn't realize you were going to do it for him because he said his live. So,
Mid-Center Tom equal treatment as everybody else.
Mid-Center Tom has an interesting point here in the chat. He said it would be interesting to go a little more in depth in how to aesthetically evaluate a video game. Hold on to that thought for the third trailer.
Second trailer.
Halo Infinite is the latest in the Halo series, and to me it looked like a Doom, or what was the other one? Counter-Strike? No, maybe not Counter-Strike, I don't know. It looked like Doom from the 90s to me. So I was watching this, and I like had a extreme sense of nostalgia. I was like, wow, this is awesome. These are like the games I actually used to play and suck at in the 90s. But as far as like a modern game, first of all, I couldn't understand what the fucking creature was saying. Yeah. I had to rewind it like 8 times to figure out his dialogue and like hold the phone close to my ear. That's the first thing. The second thing is, this does not look interesting to me at all. So this for me, I'm a video game layman, but I would rather just go back and play the games from the 90s.
Tackle.
So yeah, I watched this live during the Xbox game reveal or whatever they called it, and I had really mixed emotions. And so I started Chris Reagan, who's a YouTuber and video game critic, I guess, along with Chris Malarity and a bunch of other folks that I like. He did a reaction to it too, and I felt really in line with what Chris was saying, and in that, yes, this, I'm glad you picked up on the Doom elements, because yeah, some of it did feel like Doom. I think that's the danger in the gameplay for this game, is that it's going to lose a little bit of Halo identity and become more like Doom. Things that bothered me, there was, we don't know much about the story, and the story is really important to Halo. And so I guess I'm interested, but I'm worried. This is definitely a game I will play. Right now, Justin, if you have a PC on Steam, you can buy the Master Chief Collection. You can play all the Halos, the original Halos on PC. And it's a lot of fun. They remastered them, and they look pretty good. Halo 2 and Halo 3 especially look really good. And so I guess if you need that nostalgia, there it is. But Halo recently has gotten out of its niche. And Halo 2 and Halo 3 were the perfect examples of the Halo games are not about realistic combat, right? They're not like Counter-Strike. They're almost hyper-realized. They're hyper-stylized combat. And that's what has always made the Halo games unique. That and the story, right? The story and the lore and the story mode and the co-op couch play. Those are the things that make a Halo game. So they've got a tall order here in order to make a worthwhile Halo game. And I don't know if they're going to be able to do it. I mean, this wasn't terrible, right? This wasn't Halo 5, but it's I don't know. It's not enough, and the game's about to release, and I don't know. There's just a lot of problems with it. But tentatively, I'm going to give this a
hug.
Before Dan goes, it wasn't Counter-Strike. I was thinking it was Half-Life. Was the other game I was trying to think of.
Yeah.
Also a first-person shooter. Yeah, so the last Halo game I played was Halo 3 back around when it came out, and I thought it was interesting, but completely did not understand what was going on with the story. There was a bunch there, but it might have just not played Halo 2 or something. It went completely over my head, and so that aspect of it was hard to engage with. Maybe it was just stupid back then. But from a story perspective, not knowing the intervening, 10 years of Halo lore that's built up, I don't really know what the stakes and stuff are. Even so, I thought they could have done a better job setting up what are the conflicts here, who are we fighting against. Instead, they had a Brute, maybe? I'll reveal my Halo ignorance. Kind of generically taunting you, like, oh, I'm going to fight you now. Can you fight good? So that part, aside from not being able to understand him, wasn't that compelling. I will have to say, though, I don't have an Xbox, so I'm not going to be playing this unless it maybe comes out on PC, but I saw enemies with jetpacks, and the Master Chief apparently has a grappling hook now, so that looks awesome. I loved the Just Cause games, which are all about the grappling hooks, and it looks like you can move yourself around, pick up other stuff. That all looks fantastic. Adds a lot of verticality to the game, which I think from the brief gameplay snippets they showed would be awesome. So I think if I had an Xbox or if it were to come out on PC, it would be a hug. Hug.
Final trailer.
Far Cry 6 is where we can really discuss Tom's comment of it would be interesting to gain a little more in-depth into how to aesthetically evaluate a video game. My initial answer to that question is I don't know, and I'm going to explain why using this trailer. So this trailer, on one hand, is beautiful and amazing, and on the other hand, scares the shit out of me. So this is about a dictator in a communist country, a fascist country, raising his son. The dictator is played by Giancarlo Esposito, and the whole trailer is about the son having to choose what to do when his father wants him to basically throw a bomb into a crowd of protesters in front of their their castle, their mansion. As a piece of movie making, it was beautiful. The way it didn't show the father's face and it focused on the son the whole time, and the graphics were great. The way it was shot was great. All of that was great from a movie making standpoint. In fact, I would see this movie. Now, I do have concerns. You know, it starts with a statue being pulled down, and this guy's a fascist. So are they going to try and make this about America? What kind of a statement are they going to make on all this stuff? It's very timely. It's interesting how Far Cry 6 has gotten a storyline that's incredibly timely, down to showing the statues being pulled down as the first shot. Now, as far as a video game goes, this is where I think video game makers are more challenged, and it makes me not be able to speak on it as well, because I think the problem with video games graphically, aesthetically is, or the challenge they face, is choice. And what I mean by that is, a movie, everything is controlled and it's predetermined. You know what's going to be in every shot, so you can control everything. With a video game, the player gets to make choices as to far as what happens with the main character that can change the way things look in ways that are not really, I mean, obviously there's only a certain amount of like routes because it's all programming that someone can go, but aren't as predictable as when you're making a movie. And now these change even more when you have things like Knights of the Old Republic, right? Where you can be a Jedi or a Sith, or these type of games that Dan was just talking about. And I would think that that would change the game wholly aesthetically if you choose to be a Jedi or a Sith. I would think things would have to look very differently, would have to sound very differently. So it's very much an open question that Tom asked, but I think this trailer, Far Cry 6, is interesting in that reason, because I think what we saw was a movie trailer. It didn't feel like I saw a video game trailer, because I don't know what the gameplay would be or anything. I still to this day do not know what the gameplay in Far Cry would ever be. I've seen a bunch of the trailers, and I always seem to be watching cinematic movie trailers, which is great. Like I said, this looks like it could be a well-done movie with what they're going for, and I would like that sort of style. You know, remember Final Fantasy back in the day tried to have that movie, and it didn't come off well. This seems to be a better execution of that. Although then it gets into, we also have to have discussions about, you know, the Uncanny Valley and why are you doing things this way? Because the character Giancarlo Esposito was playing looked just like him. So why not just have actors? Why do we even have to animate it? There are questions there as well. So I still don't know what a Far Cry gameplay would be like. So I am going to give my response to this, but it's as a movie trailer. And I think this is so well done. And I'm going to be benevolent because I didn't see anything that's really favoring the fascism and really favoring social justice warriors. I'm going to be benevolent and say hug on this.
Netflix and hug.
Well, yeah, I think this looks like a very good Far Cry game. You know, it's funny you mentioned about the gameplay. It's, you know, I think that the idea of the Far Cry games is that you're in some of the games, you're very much like faced with a tragic choice, right? And it looks like the tragic choice here is like your circumstances are, you are, I'm imagining you're playing as the son, right? And you're born into this world that is just indescribably evil, right? Like, how do you navigate these choices? Of, you know, you're the son of this dictator, and he's been molding you to take over for him, right? And how are you going to do that? And how do you, you know, what do you do with this society that's crumbling? I think it's a fascinating setting for a game. So, yeah, looks like a lot of fun. So, I'll hug it.
Hug. Yeah, so in keeping with the previous one, I've played up through, well, I've actually only played Far Cry 3. To answer your question about what kind of game it is, Justin, it's their first-person shooters. Generally, you know, shooting down a bunch of, you know, random NPC enemies. Far Cry 3, at least, had a bunch of animals that you could fight, or you know, turn loose on the enemies, and so there's an interesting dynamic with that as well. I think in most or maybe all of them, you play as a guy who is not, from the beginning, a badass action hero. In Far Cry 3, you're literally a tourist who gets captured by some mercenaries or slavers, and then have to figure out how to survive on this, you know, random middle of nowhere tropical island. And so over time, you go from being this sort of soft tourist to becoming more battle-hardened and ruthless. And you have some choices to make, and it is interesting because those choices have impact on the gameplay. And so I think in this one, you could have a, assuming you do play as the kid, you'd have some real interesting choices of, do I support the regime or support the people against it? And hopefully they do a good job of actually portraying it as, well, you can support the revolutionaries, but they can also be violent and kill people, and like make it a non-obvious choice of like, well, I don't know, this, maybe this would just devolve into anarchy and that's not good, but the dictatorship is bad. There's a real interesting concept to be played with there, and from what I know of previous Far Cry games, they seem to have done a good job of that. So the portrayal of the dictator and his motivations of, oh, these people would be lost without me and I have to save them from themselves, that kind of seems like a accurate portrayal of what some of the mindset of real life dictators have been and how they talk, and I appreciate them not just making it a like cartoon mustache twirling evil guy. So this one I'm liking. This is a definite hug.
I didn't know which one was the drop there, so well done. All right, I think that about sums up our episode, wraps it up here. What did we learn this trip, Dan?
That the coronavirus is worth it for the plastic bags.
William?
I learned that next time I'm not feeling like work, I'll just call in gay. Justin, what did you learn this trip?
I learned how to think about the aesthetics of video games in a way I never had thought about before, dealing with the issue of sort of the lack of predictability that exists in video games that does not exist in movies. All right, I want to thank everyone for listening. Thanks, Dan, for coming on again. It's always a pleasure. I remember last time you didn't really want to plug yourself. Are you still with that? You just like people listening to you, but you don't want them to find you?
Yeah, well, I did find there's a Daniel Hackney who is the VP and Senior Counsel of Global Affairs at Chubb, which is a property and casualty insurance company. And so, you know, maybe give him some love. That's company's probably having a tough time with the coronavirus now.
Okay, tell them the Midside sent you, I guess.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us. We love our libertarians. We know you're having a tough time out there recently with the whole way the left has really started to go after you and try and make you look like hypocrites for not supporting the rioters. You're not a hypocrite for not supporting the rioters. You have principles, and you understand that the rule of law applies to people who accept the same principles as you, not who just want to destroy your life. If you ever want a t-shirt or anything, you can go to midside.com/store. Like I said at the top of the show, you can support us at Patreon or locals.com. It's patreon.com/themidside, themidside.com/patreon, themidside.locals.com, or themidside.com/locals. Those are, you know, per month, per piece of content. Go check out any of those if you enjoy what we say here. And as always, the most important thing you can do is tell a friend. That is the best way to grow this show. If you hear what we say and you think we're rational and you think we're enjoyable, we really need to find more people like us nowadays. And I don't mean that to make the show bigger. I mean to make our lives better. We just all need to find each other and share our values together. That's the best way we can start improving the world and building back up from where we are. This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Emblesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a substantive day. So can I tell Governor Cuomo that I'm allowed to just buy drinks and not food because I've called in gay? Like, can we make these things combine?
Oh my God, it's intersectionality.
Baby, I've invented something.